and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're looking into our meteorological crystal balls as we ask the question, how do you forecast the weather? Over the next half hour, we'll be going behind the scenes to learn about the science behind forecasting and how that makes it onto the screen with a trip to Britain's behemoth of weather, the Met Office. We'll speak to a seasoned presenter in Melbourne, Lavinia Nixon, about delivering the weather report live on air. And over in France, we'll get into the rhythm of the French shipping forecast. We predict sunny skies and plain sailing ahead on Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. We all take the weather forecast for granted, don't we? It's a given that each day you can switch on the TV, radio or your computer and find out whether you'll need your sandals or snow boots each day. It's also seemingly a permanent source of irritation. If you get caught short in the rain without an umbrella, it's easy to blame the weather forecast, isn't it? Well, according to Dan Gardner, co-author of Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction, the weather is the most accurate of all forecasts.
People like to make jokes about weather forecasting, but in fact, meteorology is the gold standard of forecasting. Meteorologists make vast numbers of forecasts. Those forecasts are recorded, measured, the data is analyzed, the results are analyzed. And so meteorologists have a very good sense of what they can and cannot forecast. They have a very good sense of what their track record is. The single biggest problem in forecasting is that we do not know what our track record is. We do not know how good or how bad we are at predicting in certain domains. And that it's that way for a particular reason. We simply do not record our forecasts, make forecasts with as much precision, or record our forecasts with as much precision, or analyze our results with as much precision as meteorologists do.
On today's show, we're going to meet some of the people behind the science and the delivery of the news that keeps you dry, safe and warm as much as possible. We're going to begin things here in the UK with a trip out west to Exeter, where we find the Met Office's headquarters. The Met Office is the main source of weather information in the UK. They supply info to TV channels, websites and radio stations nationally. We sent reporter Tara Judah to meet senior operational meteorologist Helen Roberts to find out about the first steps of predicting the weather.
Forecasting is quite an in-depth process, as I'm sure you can imagine, but to try and get to the bones of the process, you have to start with the observations, because if you don't know what the current state of the atmosphere is, then you've got no real chance of predicting what it's going to do in the future. So it's all about getting as many observations from across the world as possible. Those observations then go into our supercomputer in a process called assimilation or data assimilation. So all those observations going into the supercomputer, giving us the current state of the atmosphere. And that's when the models and the sums and the maths and the physics all take over, and the atmosphere is split into grid boxes. And at each corner of those grid boxes, the sums take place. So we know what the atmosphere is doing now, and then we run the model and see what the atmosphere is going to be doing in the future, and that gives us our forecast. But then that's not where the process ends, because then the human meteorologists come in, and we're there for a number of different reasons. One is because the model isn't always right, it's not perfect, so we're constantly comparing the model output with reality, with the observations, and we're also there almost like an interpreter. So if we just gave raw model data to a customer, it wouldn't necessarily be very useful. So we're interpreting that data and putting it into a language that our many and varied customers can understand.
How does that information go from the next step? Who you work with, who you give the information on to, how does that disseminate then through all the other channels to how we get it as the public?
Our job is to take that model data, package it into a format that is then used by the presenters across a number of different national broadcasters, and then they in turn take that information and package it up for the public. So we've kind of got two customers here in the media team. We've got the presenters, but then obviously always bearing in mind the public, because they're ultimately our customers at the end of the day.
I'm sure it's really difficult to get the weather absolutely 100% right all of the time. One of the things I always notice is that there's the percentage of rain that it says on the app on my phone, and you know, it might already actually be raining and it might say it's 40% chance of rain. How much did probability play into this? If you're taking data from so many different places and putting that together, how difficult is it to get a kind of a very clear picture of what it's going to be like?
Probability and uncertainty is a really interesting one, and it's a huge topic and one that we're constantly trying to battle with. And as you just pointed out there, you gave the example of 40% chance of precipitation, and if it's raining then you might see that as an inaccurate forecast, but actually what you've got to do is take 10 examples of it saying 40% chance, and then on four of those occasions, you know, you'd expect it to rain. So it's a tricky one, because you can't take these situations in isolation. But probability is an area that we're looking at. We certainly use it as meteorologists all of the time. We're always talking in terms of probability and uncertainty. Less so when we're delivering that information to the public. And that's just really, I think, a historical thing. It's the way that we've done it in the past, and it's difficult to change. But I think increasingly we are going down that route. So I think you'll see more instances of probabilities and numbers and percentages, or different ways of representing that. And I don't know what that might be, and we've got some very creative and clever people in this building looking at that very topic. One of the ways that we do probabilistic forecasting as opposed to deterministic, and briefly the difference is, a deterministic forecast gives you one answer saying this is what the forecast is going to be, whereas a probabilistic forecast will give you a number of different scenarios, but perhaps with a percentage attached to each of them. And the way that we do that is with ensemble forecasting, and that's when we will run the model a number of times with very, very slightly different starting conditions. And as we know with the sort of butterfly effect, as a small difference in the starting conditions can actually end up with big differences in the solution. So what we do is we run a number of different models with these very slightly different starting conditions, and if they're all giving us the same answer at the end, then we can be quite confident in the forecast. But if they're all saying wildly different things, then we have to start wondering why that is and which of those scenarios is most likely.
Do the presenters come here to work with you to get training at all, or is it really just a matter of they have to receive all of the information from you? How closely are they, you know, sort of working with the media team on the packages before they go to air?
It very much depends on the broadcaster and the company, because sometimes we will use our meteorologists to present. Sometimes it's people who used to be meteorologists who are now presenters with that company. Sometimes it's presenters from that company who come to us for some training in meteorology. So either way, they've certainly got a really good basic understanding of the weather and meteorology and how it works, because that's imperative for them to be able to communicate that effectively onto the public. But varying different levels of training within that scope. I enjoy talking to non-meteorologists about the weather, because it's very interesting to get different people's perceptions of different words or phrases, or, you know, how people without the meteorological training understand what we're trying to communicate. And that's really what it's all about. And sometimes the answer to those questions can be really surprising. One word that is differently understood by many different people is showers, and it seems like such a basic thing to a meteorologist. We know exactly what we mean by a shower, and actually specifically what we mean by a shower is precipitation falling from a cumulus cloud. Well, if you ask, you know, your man in the street what a shower is, I'm pretty sure that's not going to be the answer that they give. And it might be that they envisage a shower as a short, sharp burst of rain. It might be that they think of it in terms of intensity, or in terms of duration, or in terms of having changeable weather, you know, sunshine and showers, so sunshine for a little bit and then a shower. And all of those are right in their own ways. But people have just slightly different perceptions of what a particular word or phrase means. And that's something that we really have to bear in mind all of the time and try and step outside of our scientific met geeky world and put ourselves in the shoes of people who just really want to know, do I need a coat? Can I put my washing out? You know, things as simple as that.
That was Helen Roberts, Senior Operational Meteorologist at the Met Office, speaking to Tara Judah all the way down in Exeter. We go now to Melbourne to meet one of the city's most recognisable faces. Lavinia Nixon has been a television presenter on Australia's Nine Network for nearly 20 years. Her ebullient personality is featured on everything from travel programmes and current affairs panels to documentaries and game shows. Since 2004, she's also read the weather for Nine's nightly news broadcast in Melbourne. It's a role that she takes very seriously and has had a lot of success with. She's gained a reputation for being able to convert complicated meteorological data into a breezy segment that feels casual and easy to digest. So how does Nixon do it? Well, Monocle's Adrian Craddock recently met up with her to find out.
Lavinia's back with the weather. Warming up again, Lavinia.
That's right, Pete. Today was the one mild day this week. Heat is building over South Australia again. Adelaide is likely to break its record of 11 days over 40 in summer. Tomorrow will actually be good here, but dangerously hot weather isn't far away. I'll have the details next. I think you need to be able to speak very clearly, as everyone on television needs to. I think you need to be able to take a lot of very complicated information and put it into layman's terms. And I think you need to have an accessible presence to you. It's such an honour to be in people's living rooms every night. And, you know, they're letting you into their space, into their home, into their time with their family. So I think you need to be very respectful of that and just do the best job that you can do.
Have you ever had any meteorological training? Is that something that you've felt compelled to do since you've had this role?
I spent a week at the Bureau before I started the role, and then it's just been hands-on training. So I have learned a lot, and I actually don't like it when weather presenters go into too much clinical detail. I think it can be quite ostracising as a viewer. So we're very conscious of, you know, obviously talking about what the weather is like coming up and explaining why it's like that, but not going into too much detail that's alienating.
You were saying before how it's important for weather presenters to be able to convey really complex information. In a city like Melbourne that has such crazy weather, I guess that you really have your work cut out for you. Do you think that in some ways, is that a challenge, you know, explaining the crazy weather changes that happen in Melbourne?
I actually think that when you have those weeks when it's partly cloudy and 23 and that's it for the entire week, that's when it becomes really difficult to write 3:30. So the fact that Melbourne does have such changeable weather gives us so much content, and it gives us the scope to be able to explain, for example, why it's been so wet for the last few weeks. And we talk about, you know, the Indian Ocean dipole and things like that. But that's about as far as we want to get because, again, going back to my point, you don't want to alienate people or bombard them with too much information. So, you know, you're trying to get a lot of information through to them in a way that's as simple as possible.
So can you walk me through your typical day? How does it work for you?
We have a producer who comes in and she starts working on the scripts, just giving the actual scripts and bones, because obviously as the day unfolds, temperatures are changing and winds are shifting, so that alters the script. We have the forecast that comes in at 4:20. So once that arrives, we go light the clappers and we're busily updating everything. We're on air at 4:40, then with the national updates, and we do it again at 5:15. Then we do a 5:45 hit. Then we're on for the Melbourne news at 6:15, 6:50, and 6:58. So all up, there's about 7.5 minutes of weather. So that's a lot of script writing, that's a lot of graphics, and it's a lot of checking, double checking. For example, a couple of nights ago, the maximum didn't come in till 5:45. So you've really got to stay on top of things and not just assume that it's done, because by its very nature, it's an ever-changing beast. So you really just have to keep an eye on everything and dot your I's and cross your T's.
And I've read that you have a challenge that other presenters don't have, at the end of your report, you have to kind of silently go up to the desk and sit down before the report is finished. Can you explain what that's about and how that works?
So for 95% of the weather report, I'm standing in front of the plasma TV talking to people about the weather. Then we go to a full frame graphic, which means all you're seeing is that graphic. And then the next shot of me is I'm sitting next to Pete saying, "Rug up tonight, Pete," or whatever the throw is. So we write it. So there's about 9 seconds where I have to keep talking and moving to the chair. It's really not that big a deal. People can talk and walk at the same time. It always seems to fascinate people how that happens, but it's really not that big a deal.
Am I not the first person to ask you about this?
No, you are not the first person to ask me about that. How do you get there to that chair? I'm like, I walk and talk.
But aren't there times where things don't go to plan? I mean, we were saying it's live television. I mean, you know, you can trip during that time. You can get to the desk and there's no chair. Has that ever happened before?
Yes, I've got to the desk before and there was no chair there, so I was doing leg squats. But yeah, they're not much fun, those instances. There have also been times when I wear two microphones every night, one as the main one and one as backup, and both those microphones have gone down. So with 15 seconds to go, I was standing there with four people around me trying to put on a microphone that worked with the back of my dress unzipped down to my waist, and I'm standing there and they're saying 10 seconds. I'm like, okay, breathe. You know, that's really quite stressful. I've had moments when my three-year-old Ted was in the studio and I had 10 seconds to go and he ran up and jumped into my arms and said, "Mummy, I need to go to the toilet." And I went, oh, well, this is interesting, isn't it? My worlds are colliding. So one of the gorgeous girls who works with us had to whisk him away to the bathroom with all of 5 seconds to go. So yes, live TV definitely keeps you on your toes.
That seems to be the real magic. It seems to be keeping this veneer of calmness and keeping it all together while in reality things are going crazy behind the scenes. Is that a kind of a fair assessment?
Well, I think everyone has those moments at work where you're trying to make it look calm and collected. And, you know, that's our job. Our job is to present the news as best we can. It's not for people at home to say, oh, well, you know, they tried their best, you know, oh, we'll forgive them that, you know, they went to the wrong story. And, you know, that wears very thin very quickly. So, you know, we have an incredibly talented, polished team and we, thank goodness, touch wood, I'm probably going to moz us, very rarely make mistakes. So, yeah, we give it our best shot every night.
I imagine it must be a very competitive industry. Is that something that you feel? I mean, are you someone that kind of flicks through the channels and looks at kind of the other weather presenters and their presentation style and takes note of that?
Don't get me wrong, I'm very competitive. I grew up with two brothers, so yeah, sometimes it was literally fighting for your life. But we are very competitive here at Nine and we look at those ratings every morning at 9:15 and we break them down minute by minute and we look at what stories work, what stories people enjoyed watching. We are super competitive, but I think internally I wouldn't say we're competitive. I would say that we are supportive of each other. But outside these walls, it's game on.
How do you see your relationship with the audience? It must be quite a special feeling to know that you're in people's lounge rooms, you know, every night having this dialogue with them.
It is. It's lovely and it is a privilege and you get to meet so many people out in the street who feel like they know you and it's great because you start this conversation already, you know, 10 minutes into it because they know that your husband's a builder, they know you've got two kids and they know this about you, they know your football team and you sort of just dive straight into these incredible conversations with people. And, you know, I've had conversations with people and they've said, oh, I feel like I've told you my life story. I've just, you know, they've told me about their lap band surgery and disabled family members. Like you have conversations that you might not necessarily have with people that you've just met, purely because people feel like they know you and that's lovely.
That was Australia's Nine Network weather presenter Lavinia Nixon speaking to Monocle's Adrian Craddock. If Cromarty, Forth, Tyne and Dogger mean anything to you, then you're probably one of the hundreds of thousands of radio listeners who enjoy the British shipping forecast each night on BBC Radio 4, or one of those test match special listeners who sort of hate it. In France, they have their own version, the Météo Marine, and like the UK equivalent, its rhythmic, almost poetic language has endeared it to even those who will never set foot on a yacht or a trawler. But as Ian Wiley reports from Paris, budget cuts mean the French are preparing to say au revoir to their shipping forecast. Here's his report.
Et bien conforme aux prévisions.
Becoming northwesterly, then veering northeasterly later 5 to 7. Rain, moderate or poor, becoming good.
The French may not be quite as obsessive as the British are about the shipping forecast for their island nation, but the daily Météo Marine broadcast by France Inter, an offshoot of Radio France, is no less evocative.
Prévision par zone pour les prochaines 24 heures. Viking, Utchard, Forties, Cromarty et Forth, de la pluie au nord. Vent de sud-ouest, force 3 à 4, temporairement force 5.
These marine weather bulletins, which cover a vast sea area in the Atlantic and the North Sea, have been broadcast since the beginning of the Second World War. For those at or about to put to sea, the forecast may mean the difference between life and death. But for land-loving radio listeners, it is more than this. As in Britain, the enigmatic liturgy of the Météo Marine is woven into the fabric of French cultural life, creating salty seascapes of the imagination. The bulletins are transmitted from a 350-metre high tower in the village of Alouis in the very centre of France. But the Météo Marine is presented from La Maison de la Radio, the headquarters of Radio France in Paris, where I've come to meet Marie-Pierre Planchon, the mermaid to her fans, who read the 900-word, 7-minute bulletin every evening at 8:03 p.m. for more than 15 years.
I replace Françoise Morasso, who was a great contributor to France Inter, mainly with political programs. And I always ask why this great journalist and radio producer continued to do the shipping forecast. She came into work at the weekends just to do the shipping forecast. She told me that she did it because of the poetic nature of the shipping forecast. She told me how it must be presented in a certain way, but to also think about those who are listening, who are not sailors. Thanks to her advice, I brought an affability to the bulletin, so that the listeners who at the time were not sailors were able to understand some words and were able to understand this music, which is the shipping forecast.
Planchon tells me she was interested in presenting the Météo Marine because she was born by the sea, in Picardy, where, on a clear day, you can see England from the Somme Bay.
What I remember most was the difficulty in finding a rhythm. But my predecessor explained it all to me really well, how to speak rhythmically, how to use pauses and breaks in speech, how to do my breathing so that it was audible. Before each bulletin, I would take my script and mark on it each pause and break in between the words, so that when it came to reading it to be broadcast, the words flowed. What I also did was take a map of all the zones and lots of photographs of those zones. And I had the card sit next to me so that each time I was talking about a certain zone, I knew exactly where it was. A journalist from The Parisien once told me it's like a sophrology session, and it's true. When I read it, it was like meditating. It was as though I left my body, and at the end I came back into my body.
The Météo Marine is broadcast only on long wave at 162 kHz. Long wave reaches much further than FM, and when conditions are fair, the Météo Marine can be heard as far away as the eastern coast of the United States. However, the very last Météo Marine on public radio will be broadcast at 8:03 p.m. on December the 31st. Like many other public broadcasters in Europe, Radio France needs to rebalance its books. It ended medium wave transmissions at the end of last year, and Chief Executive Mathieu Gallet wants to save another €13 million a year by turning off long wave transmissions at the end of this year. The forecasts are produced by meteorologists in Toulouse, then prepared for France Inter by a Météo France media team in Paris, led by Emmanuel Beaucry. Boukri, who is a sailor himself, says Radio France tried to pull the plug on the Météo Marine before, until angry listeners protested.
When you listen the bulletin, it's very specific. It's like a music. You have a specific vocabulary. But if you are not a sailor, you don't understand what they say. It's impossible. But they like to listen this music, this melody.
This time, it seems unlikely that the Météo Marine will be spared. A petition to save Long Wave has achieved only 1,100 of the 100,000 signatures it needs. But will loss of the French shipping forecast on public radio make a difference to sailors? I called Frank Singleton, a former forecaster in the UK Met Office, who also spends 4 months a year sailing, often in French waters.
Hello.
According to Singleton, most ships now have onboard technology that provides the forecast they need, such as NavTax, a text-based system. The Météo Marine, he reckons, is used only as a backup.
Within about 30 miles of the coast, you should be able to hear Marine VHF broadcasts from Coast Guard stations around France and the UK, of course. You should be able to hear those. The French have got a fairly good network of coastal stations. We sail around France a lot, and we use them, so there wouldn't be a disaster in that sense. And, of course, more and more people are using the internet these days, and a lot of stuff is on the internet, and as long as you're within, I suppose, 10 miles of the coast, you can probably get the internet over your cell phone. And not a great safety issue. I suspect, a bit like the UK, it may be almost more of a, it's always been there, why is it being dropped?
But Marie-Pierre Planchon believes the Météo Marine remains an important public service.
What I also quickly understood was that it was a serious bulletin. It had to be done properly according to its structure, not just however you felt like doing it, unlike an economics bulletin, for example. Once I was in the studio reading the forecast, and there was a presenter called Jean-Louis Foulquier, who jokingly took his lighter and set lights on my shipping forecast as I was reading it. Luckily, I had a glass of water, but I scolded him for not taking it seriously. There are people who need the correct information from us.
Current presenter Annie Kavarian, who is also an actor, says she hopes the Météo Marine will live on in other forms.
Maybe to some sort of internet platform, but I would certainly like to carry on reading the shipping forecast. I don't want it to end. And I think there will be many people who will miss it. Not only sailors, but also perhaps others who just enjoy listening to the bulletin and learning about it. I think these people won't want it to end either after such a long time. A written forecast is one thing. Hearing the forecast is another. They're not the same.
For Monocle, in Paris, I'm Ian Wiley.
That completes the shipping forecast.
Thank you, Ian. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Fairweather or Foul Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week, when we'll be taking a look at alternative art spaces, from galleries in people's houses and shop windows to one down a telephone line. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.